The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The cheapnesses of life, or the corruption around us, just by that I think we begin to go into reality. And we begin to discover the beauties. And as I say to my friends, Christianity is joy. But if it becomes a Pepsodent smile, forget about it. You can have the joy, but you can never have the joy if there are not also tears, just because the beautiful things are destroyed or are threatened to be destroyed. You cannot say, I love people, if you're not weeping when you see that some of your students or whatsoever is destroyed by drugs or whatsoever. And I think the tears and the laughter go together. The beauty of Christianity is that we can still laugh, even in the midst of all this negative sin, death, corruption, violence, rape, etc., etc. Because we know that finally those things don't win, but that Christ and everything he stands for and that he brings with him is victorious. So if you cut out, as some people try to do, the Last Judgment out of Christianity, then I would say forget about all your laughters. And that's what you see, that modern theological people are very, very tense because they have to change the world. And I would say, yes, we have a calling, but salvation is God's. Thank the Lord, I don't have to do it myself. Well, these are a little bit kind of things. So that's what I'm trying to teach people. Just try to make something good. And don't try to be Christian, because even to think what spirituality means is so difficult. We barely know what it is. I saw a hand.
Yes?
I would say it was a silly undertaking. Is that an answer? I think you cannot tear Christ down to be of no value, because if it has little iconic value, they have to turn it down to little value. And why should you make it? You see, if you want to talk about Christ, it must be loaded with the meaning, as much meaning as you can. But it's so difficult. You cannot make a painting in which you have, at this exhibition, there was one painting, three people in a room. And the painting was made in order to portray the fact that where two or three are gathered in his name, he is present. Wonderful. The picture shows three people very intense together, beautiful. Where was Christ? I didn't see that. So the woman who made it, who I happened to know, came up to me and she saw my little painting and said, no. Well, and she brought me there and we looked at it. I said, oh yes, I have seen it. I didn't realize it was yours. And she said, she told me that that's what she wanted to portray. And I said, but where's Jesus? And then she said, don't you see him on the wall? And on the wall was a shadow, and in the shadow was Christ's face. I must say that I told her, yes, I see it. But to be honest, I didn't see it. But I think, and I told her so on the spot. And I thought, can I do this? Is that not very unkind, because she has been working so hard on it? But nevertheless, I want to help her along, and time is short, and I'm just here for a moment. So I did tell her, I say, you're wrong. Your picture is a beautiful picture, but it does not portray the presence of Christ. Because if you want to portray that, then you must understand that Christ in our midst is a reality which is so strong that if you had made a granite block in the middle of the room, that would be the presence of Christ. And then we would have been the shadows, just to make a kind of comparison. You see, Christ being spiritual doesn't become ghost-like, but is very concrete. Well, how can you portray this? I must say, I don't know. And so before I want to portray even such a simple Christian theme, I would rather wait than just jump to it before I can. And so your uniconic Christ, I'd rather not have it. I'm jumping to another subject, if I may, because this is very difficult. Missionary art, that was a problem that was posed to me. I think missionaries made great mistakes in the past. And of course you make great mistakes, because the problem is awfully difficult. You come in a country and you teach these people Christianity. What are you doing on the cultural level? Do you introduce your hymns? Do you introduce your little Jesus pictures? Or don't you? And I think the biggest mistake was made, let's say more than a century ago, and was exemplified, I just gave as an example, something that Kefa told me. He has been thinking very much about this, and he said that around 1880, let's say 100 years ago, there was a missionary in West Africa, and a friend of his wrote to him, "Now you're there in Africa, what kind of music do these people have?" The answer was, "These people have no music, they only make noise." Translate that in sensible language, it means, I never try to understand it, I don't care what these people do. But if you don't care what these people do, and if you don't care where they are at, you're not interested in them as people. How can you bring the gospel to people that you're not interested in? Well, I know what this missionary was interested in. He was interested in their souls. But how can you reach souls without bodies? You reach no bodies. Well, in the end, you get no bodies. And there are too many no bodies around in the mission field. You see, so we got to really think what we're doing. It's a very difficult question. If you ask me my answer, which is probably an impossible answer, my ideal of what ought to have done would be something like this. And it has been done sometimes. First it has been done by Paul, and later it has been done by some missionaries in China. And there's a little book that came out of it, The Jesus Family in Communist China. Maybe you know it, it's 20 years old by now. I've forgotten the writer. And what I think that we ought to have done is to go to these people, the pagans, preach to them the gospel, and as soon as they have accepted the gospel, say, "Praise the Lord, hallelujah, here you have a Bible, goodbye, God bless you." What we did, incidentally, we began to coax them like they were little children, to send the missionaries more, never to teach them anything, because these people were so stupid and they didn't understand anything and they were so very bad at organization and so on and so on, because we expected these people immediately to jump into 20th century Western society. But why should we even think and dream of these people become westernized cultural people? Because what we have in our own culture today is crisis. Why should we export the crisis of our Western culture? You see, let these people start anew. Now, of course, that's a dream. That's past. We have made it. We have done it. We have brought our music. That means we have killed their music. We have brought our art. That means we have killed their art. We have brought our literature. That means we have killed their literature. Well, where do we start? At this moment, I really stop because I don't know the answers. I have one very, very intelligent student. Nobody knows his name here, I guess, and if you did know, I won't mention it. And this man, I tried to lure into making a thesis on this problem, missionary Christian art. He thought about it and he said, no. A, there is no literature on the subject. And B, there's almost no practice on the subject. I don't know where to start. That means, again, we should start somewhere, and maybe if we begin to think about it in 25 years from now, that thesis can be written. And let's hope that it will be written in 25 years. It's a very difficult problem. I began to say to Kefa, when he wanted to make a thesis for me, get a doctor's degree, I said, I want you to write about teaching art history in Africa. What do you teach if you teach at a Christian school in Africa? Do you teach these people Rembrandt and Raphael and Gothic? Or are you refraining from that? But what do you teach them? Well, Kefa very commonsensically said to me, I'm not writing that thesis because I should be in my own country and trying out these things. You see, you should try, you should work on it. And then probably an answer could be formulated. But it's a very difficult answer. The tragedy is, again, that you wished you could say to these people, we have something wonderful to offer you. Look, our art teachers, they come and they teach you. But what we really bring to them is crisis, ugliness often. And apart from that, we destroy what they have. And we take away their own initiative. Very difficult. So it means what I'm saying at this, there was a question, and I think it's a good question, but my answer basically is I don't know. So that was, I just said too many words to just paraphrase, I don't know.
Yes?
Wasn't that, you had a painting of a Haitian crucifixion.
Yes.
Isn't that missionary art?
I don't know, maybe it wasn't, because Christianity in Haiti is old. And I don't think that was missionary art. I think it came from themselves. And I thought it better than what you usually see.
But well, it seems that, you know, when you talk about, maybe I don't understand, you mean by missionary art something that the missionaries will encourage among the people?
Yes. And so if you take a boat and you go to Asia, you land in Hong Kong, you go to Japan, you travel through China, don't think for one moment about Mao, but just think about, then go to Indochina and go to India. What you see hanging on the walls, A, in the missionary's office, B, with the Christians outside, C, in their books that they publish, you see the most awful, low, cheapest kind of things that it's really unimaginable that it was ever made. It's so horrible and bad. But if you go in the non-Christian world outside, you see the same thing. It's very cheap. It's very bad. And Indians, I just had an Indian magazine some time ago in which there's a long discussion. Why did we Indians who have produced so many good things in the past have such a low taste that we buy all this trash? And the trash is not coming from Europe. It's produced in their own country. And how much is that due to the introduction of Christianity? Or how much is that a result of the clash and the overwhelming influence of Western culture coming to these countries? Or how much is due to the decay of everything inside these countries as such? That's the very difficult problem that I wanted this intelligent man to do, because he's more intelligent than I am. But he refrained. It was too difficult a problem. So don't ask me to give you answers in 5 minutes.
Oh, Benjamin Warfield has an essay on the significance of the Bible in culture, that a great deal the shape of cultures has been determined by the movement of the Bible into that culture.
Yes, of course, true. But look at Europe. If I say that the high point of Christian art is to be found in the 17th century, Schütz, Rembrandt, Sweling, some writers, John Donne maybe, well, let's go on and let's stop. If that's true, then that means that that is 1700 years after Jesus Christ. So 1600 years after the crucifixion and the resurrection, something was happening. Not quite true, because in Gothic there's something possible, but even Gothic, 13th century, 1200 years after Christ. Yes, it was a little bit earlier, but it takes hundreds of years before something is realized. You read in your book, early Christian art. If you buy some of these textbooks, then you will find early Christian art. What do you find? Art in Ravenna, 500 after Christ. That means more than 400 years after Christ. That means that's a distance from here, 1975, it's 19 minus 4, 1575. Yeah, just after the Reformation. That kind of distance.
I just wonder, I know it's a large issue, but is that entirely fair, since we're saying that art is one of these undefinable realities which impinges itself upon us, and in that sense, the carpentry of the first century BC is, if it's Christian, it's as representative of the influence of Christ and the Bible on culture,
yes,
as any other kind of definite,
yes,
art.
Okay, but you're an optimist, because if I look at the works of these people in the first century, I see no difference to that what is produced by the surrounding cultures. There are only one negative, that they didn't have the idols. You see, they began to be negative, and then slowly, but if I really can talk with any positive meaning about Christian art, then I really got to wait till the year 300 or 400. And it doesn't go that quick, and we shouldn't be optimistic. Of course, something was done in the meantime, because if there had not been done something in the meantime, we wouldn't have the art in the year 400. But it doesn't come in one day, it becomes the hard work of generations. And I'm trying to say to you, don't expect it tomorrow, but work hard in order that your great-grandchildren may have it.
Yeah, I don't... It's hard for me to separate, you know, painting or the particular isolation of painting as art from any other life.
Of course, but I'm talking about painting and music and literature and poetry and theater and everything you can imagine. And I think about sermons and theology. When was anything like Christian thinking coming? We talk about Augustine as an early Christian. When is he living? 400 years after Christ. Not 20 years after Christ. Who is the great thinker 20 years after Christ? Paul. Well, that's the beginning. You see, but Augustine, that's already 400 years. When is Calvin? 1500 years after Christ. You see, we shouldn't take that it comes so easily. And these things all go together. And of course, these things are very difficult. And if we had gone to Africa and had just given these people the gospel and the Bible had gone, that means that we would have said to them, or had thought, we should never have said, but we should have thought, I come back in 500 years to see a Christian culture here. But it would have been a Christian culture and not the bad thing that we see now. Which is not the fault of the Africans, but our fault. I don't know whether it could have been avoided. These questions raise so many more new questions, but I think we should see the issues right. And then I think there's something to be discussed, but it's too difficult. I really don't know the answers.
Dr. Ruckmark, you've talked a lot about the value of creating art in line with reality. And I was wondering if there are any abstract paintings that you know of which you would call Christian.
Oh, yes. That's the little thing that was implied in the question, in the answer that I gave to the last question, and that I said there is 20th century art and there is modern art. In the 20th century, there is also non-figurative art. I showed you some in my lecture last week. That non-figurative art does not need to be modern in the specific sense I mentioned last week. Can you use that for a Christian expression? And I would say it just depends what you're talking about. If you choose the fabrics for your windows, of course the forms are, in 9 out of 10, non-figurative. If you make a cover for your book, it's probably non-figurative. Can we make something as loaded and, in a way, more important? That doesn't mean more valuable, but only, yes, higher on the cultural ladder. Again, that doesn't say that everything else is unimportant, but it only says it's different. Everything has its own place. There's some kind of things that are important in one place and another. You're not always preaching, but there's a place for preaching. So in a way, there's a place for paintings, but not all things ought to be paintings. Well, but let's say you make a painting, or you write a book, or and so on, fill it in. Can that be non-figurative? And my answer would be, why not? But I've never seen one. Because I want to ask some much more reality in it than you can convey by non-figurative means. And I'm always telling stories, but something comes to my mind. May I tell this with names? No, I shouldn't. But I was somewhere in America and somebody came to me. And that somebody was representing an art department of a Christian school. And that person came to me and said, now look, this is the work of my staff. It was all non-figurative art. Later on, we had a discussion which turned out to be violent just because she said that a Christian could never paint any nudes. That was the old issue. And I thought, isn't that silly? Because, I was very violent, not for the nudes, because that's not the main issue, as you may have understood. I'm not thinking that this is the only thing we should do. But I think that we should go into reality, because these paintings were all escapism. They avoided to talk about anything serious in the world. And they are not only escapism, but they are also, and very strongly so, mysticism. And mysticism is, again, these were the paintings that showed the spirituality of people whose souls were saved, but way out of the world. Saving here meant have nothing to do with the world. Those were the people who are not fighting racism, never standing against anything that's in corruption in the Western society, never caring for television, and so on and so on. Well, their paintings show. And the interesting thing is that their paintings were more worldly than everything I've seen that Christians do. Just because they tried to shun away from the world, what they were basically doing was something that you will find in every art school in America. And they had the same trite, nonsensical, no statements that you find young students do when they first try to grapple with these things. I'm not talking about the real serious and great non-figurative artists you have in America, but there are quite a few here. But I'm talking about the average. And they're just nice little decorative things without much meaning. Well, that's what it is. And I would say, if that's Christian, then I don't want to be a Christian. You see? And I think that's not what we're fighting for. And that's why I think we should avoid this question. Again, I answered the question and said, you don't choose a style. You don't think, can I make a non-figurative painting? That's not the way to think. You make a painting and you say something. And if you can do it, or if that's where you're led to with non-figurative forms, and there may be a place where it is very valuable to do it in non-figurative forms, well, then you do it. And we stand and we may debate it and say, has he made the right choice, yes or no? But not, did he do according to the little laws that Dr. Rockmarker laid down? You see what I mean?
My main concern was if you had seen any non-figurative paintings.
I haven't seen any, and I don't believe in it. Manet, some people tried. Manet tried, and I think that he did things which, well, would say something, but are far below the level that I want art to communicate. And in a way, he is not an escapist, Manet, French Roman Catholic painter, but I would bring him into the line of a kind of Roman Catholic mysticism, just like Le Corbusier's Roman Catholic mysticism. And Chagall is Jewish mysticism. And Rothko, one of the most strong and very extraordinary non-figurative artists that the 50s have produced in America, is a Jewish mystic. These things go together. And mysticism is very near to Gnosticism. It's not exactly the same, but very near to it. Yes, the second commandment in relationship to art. Now we begin at the beginning. Oh, sorry, yes?
In trying to formulate a Christian scheme of art or the aesthetic of art, I was wondering if there is a way to bridge over transcultural barriers as Christians in general, in reaching some type of an approach in our various homes or in the whole attitude of Christian life in general, in order to have a complete statement of fact that that speaks out to people. In other words, you mentioned, well, if you go to places in the Orient or India, you look in missionaries' homes, the art is poor. If you go out, the art is poor. I find in the Orient, more often than not, in the Christian or in the missionary type home, yes, the art is poor. You go out, the art is fantastic. I mean, like in Japan, for instance, they really are aware of an aesthetic. They concentrate on this whole aspect of beauty. And you see it in their homes, you see it in their gardens. It is inculcated in their very life itself. Even in China, cleanliness is just everywhere.
Okay, but
it's simplistic,
yes.
And yet it's everywhere. And then you have missionary kids who have a problem. They come back to the States. Mm-hmm. They go to these different missionary homes and say, if this is what Christianity is, if this is what it represents, it's ugly. I don't want it. Because the homes, the art in the homes, the lives themselves are inconsistent with the biblical position of Christianity. And there's not an overall aesthetic beauty that is presented, that is even enacted in the life or in the home.
Yes.
Now, how can we as Christians, in a general sense of all being under the realm of the children of God, present to the world a beautiful aesthetic Christian art?
Well, that is exactly what I've been talking about all the time, and what you have been saying, it could have come exactly with the same words out of my own mouth. And it would end up with the same question. And then my answer is, I don't know the answer, but I know it's something valuable to fight for, and let's take 50 years or one or two generations to do it, because the answer is so difficult. That was my answer to him, and that's my answer in my whole course. I don't know the answers, and we don't know the answers. Nobody knows the answers, because we have simply not asked the very first question. You state the very first question, which I've stated all through my course, and I do agree that's the big question, and it means that we got to get moving, and I would say that some little things have been done, and if I present some of the little things, it only creates misunderstandings, because people are not ripe yet to understand what we're heading for, and I'm just beginning to see the beginnings of it, and I would say we got to take time, but we can never reach that point that you are craving for, and rightly so, because if not, we lose our message, or we rather have lost our message because it's the neglect of previous generations why this has come so. We talked about it a couple of minutes ago. So how do we do it? Well, it's the thinking, working, fighting, going, showing other people, but that's not the aim, that's just the result, that we are really aiming for something that is real and worthwhile. And the beauty, of course, the art is not the aim. We are not people who live for art, we live for life. We live for Christ because he is the giver of life. You see, so art is just the expression of it. So we got to change our lives. Without the Reformation, a real deep change in our spiritual understanding, our creedal statements, our biblical grasp of things, this will never come up. As long as these people of that particular school that I was thinking about don't really repent and change their ways and reform, have a reformation. Without that, they will never get anywhere, and they will remain as mystical, and they will go on doing that little thing that we were just talking about. So talking about the East, it's everywhere. I talk about our own world. We just talked a little bit about the other countries, which is very, very important, but I know little about, and I refrain upon talking about things I know little about. But you're right. That's exactly what I'm fighting for. So you were just saying what I was saying. And I was saying, let's begin. Yesterday. The second commandment. We really got down to the real big problem. The second commandment in relationship to art. I would feel very bad. I have 3 minutes to answer the question. It's very interesting that in the beginning of history, people did thought very much of that question. Usually it's not stated today. And first answer was, no, we cannot make any visual art. And I think that they were right, because you were living in a culture where you had all the idols around you every day, and they said, we cannot make, well, our Jesus just like they make their Apollo. So we refrained. They refrained for about 200 years. And then it began to change. And the point was where it began to change when people realized that we are made in the image of God. And if we are made in the image of God, what does that mean? The first answer is this. Has anybody seen God? No? Yes, of course we have seen him. Jesus was God. So we are in the image of Jesus. So Adam resembled Jesus because he was made in the image of God, which is a very interesting and I don't think a trite thought. It's a very good and deep thought. And he said, but then we can make images of man and of Christ. And so, very slowly and reluctantly, they went in. Only a couple of hundred years later, coming out of a rather mystical stream, and that means that I'm suspicious, came the answer, no, if we are made in the image of God, it's spiritual. It's our character. And then we go into an art which is, let's say, the middle part of the Middle Ages, which is truly and really spiritualistic, trying to avoid to portray the world around us. That is, let's say, early Romanesque and Romanesque. And they have the other answer. I personally feel that it is, in a way, a wrong question, because what the Bible says very strong is that we should not make images in order to adore them. And I think that's the emphasis. Just like the whole Bible says, don't follow the idols, don't follow the false gods. And that is still true. You see, so that's the great importance and emphasis. If not, I don't understand the Bible anymore, because, for instance, at the great temple of Solomon on the very porch, you had the great fountain and sea, as they called it, and it was built or put on 12 bulls. And you had all these images of these cherubs and so on. So there was figurative art in Israel. There was a portrayal of plants and beasts and man. But what was wrong, that was that in Bethel they made a calf and said, that's my God. And that's ready for destruction. So if I think about European art, then I would say all these sculptures of saints that people pray for are against the second commandment. And I can so very well understand our reformers who are our friends when they destroyed these images, because people had been deceived by them. They were idols. and they had to be destroyed. That's according to the scriptures. So, but it's not just the fact that you make a picture. I think that's too simple, and it is, in a way, too little. Here's a question about gallery art, and that gallery art is so far out of reality, and that is something really difficult. I talk about it a little bit in my book, that the art in the gallery is so, yes, it's such a desperation to begin with for the artist himself. He tries to say something, and I'm an exceptional man because I talk about content, but most art critics, not to speak about art historians, they don't speak about content, and that's the confusing thing. So you are shown around the Museum of Modern Art, and you're told that these things are telling you the same things as ever was saying before, and in the end you're really brainwashed out of any understanding of what you were seeing. And that's a desperation for the artist to begin with. Now, what's our answer? Our answer is, and it's in line with what that lady in the backside was saying this morning about missionary art, it's the same problem. We should cut through art as being something autonomous on its own. In a way, we have so much deep breaks in our culture, the break between popular culture and high culture, between fine arts and, let's say, the art you can buy in the supermarket. And that's, of course, a kind of imitation of the fine arts. But then you have a side of that, well, there are many little things that we now have in our homes, ceramics and so on. And we have put all kinds of barriers. And the same applies with music. No musician who thinks himself to be somebody would make popular music. And popular music, for that matter, has grown very low, unless you are colored, because if you're colored black, then you have no chance probably to get into the fine music field, and so you got to make popular music, and that's why black men's popular music is so fantastically strong, because the good men are working there. So you have all kinds of strange problems in our culture, and I think we got to think and to work to try to break through, to solve these problems that are not just the Christians' problems, that they are our culture's problems, that everybody who understands anything about these things is thinking about, and that nobody has been able to find a solution to. Now, the solution is never just a little book or a little definition or a fine plan. It is to be worked out, and it's so big that it will take certainly one or two or three generations, but that's not something to despair about, because the fun is in the making and not in the result. But just to work at it is very important. It will take quite a time, but I think we ought to work on it. Whether we will succeed is not a problem. That's not the question, because we don't ask whether we will succeed or whether what we're doing is important. And I think we ought to try. The answer is not another kind of utilitarian art, the Christian utilitarian art, because I think that's really ugly. We shouldn't be prostituting art for something that art was not made for, particularly evangelism. I don't know whether that was the meaning of this question, but I tried to talk around it. Was it right? I don't know whose question it was. Yours? Yes?
My idea was in the statements that you made about the fairly new concept of gallery art, say in the 18th century, maybe, when
yes,
they started to spell
an art. Yes, well, we should make a new development that comes back to another point, and that's the hard work. And first we got to pose the questions. We're just beginning to see the questions. And some of the books that are mentioned in the book list deal with that problem. Should a Christian spend $10 on a really great concert when his Christian brother in Africa is starving to death? Or should a Christian church build a fabulous building and spend $500,000 on it? This is a matter of priorities. And I think that Christ, God himself, was very careful when he said that you should love your neighbor as yourself. And I don't think that Christianity asks for you to go around naked so that somebody else gets clothed. It doesn't ask us to be poor and in the sense of having nothing and just to refrain from all things in order that we may help in the other places. Basically, we will find very soon as we begin to analyze the problem that even if I send my $10 to Africa, that in a way it would falling in a void and it wouldn't help, because the problem is not money but something else, as people who were doing try to help the third world are beginning to find out. First they thought just send money, but that's a Western European answer, that's a Western culture answer. When Europe after the last war was really broke, America sent money, but and Europe recovered, but that was within a Western culture system, but it's not in a third world system. It doesn't work like that. So the $10 are thrown to nothing if you do that. On the other hand, and of course, if you don't spend the $10 on the concert, then of course your implication is that many people shouldn't spend the $10 on the concert and do it for something else. That means that these musicians are going to starve and that the culture is going to decay. So you got to see what the implications are. Now I think that there are limits, that there are priorities, but that this, in a way, is an overstatement to put the question like this, and maybe it was meant to be an overstatement, but that there are limits. If somebody said, well, I could go to a concert and each place for $75, and I refrained from going there because that was a little too much for that one musician that evening, I would say, yes, that's right. That's beyond the limits. That's too much. But and where the limit exactly is very difficult to draw. It depends on so many things that there is no answer to it, not an easy answer. But I think that every time that you go, you know the answer in that specific situation. You may spend, in a very short span of time, quite a bit of money, and it's important. And another time you would say, no, I can't even spend half of that because of something else that has a priority. About this building of a church, which is a much bigger issue, I must say that I've been very worried very interestingly, the last month, we have had quite a few young Christians coming to La Brie with a big question. The first time they came to me was about half a year ago. Can a church get rich? Or rather, how do we avoid the church getting rich? Or, to phrase it differently, how will a church invest its money? And these were very intriguing questions for me, and we began to talk about it. And to my mentality, it is impossible that a church ever invests money. A church should never get rich. It's impossible that a church gets rich. I would say, and in discussing, we laid down some rules, which of course are not absolute rules, but that the church should never have more money in reserve than, let's say, 1 year's budget. And that everything that's beyond that, it's too much. To invest money, I have big questions about interest and investment and that kind of use of money are big questions to me. So I think a church cannot get rich. I have questions about the way you have your offerings. I was in a church a couple of days ago, and it was an offering, but they never told me what the offering was for. And I was almost saying, I'm not giving anything. I want to know what I'm giving it for. For the maintenance of the church, for the payment of the salary of the minister, or for Africa, or for India, or maybe for the help to a certain kind of organization. Maybe I don't like that organization and I don't want to give money. You see, and I think that a church should announce, now we're going to collect for this. And if the collection is taken, then you should give that money totally. That means then you have nothing to divide and you don't have anything left over. If nevertheless you get rich at a certain moment, that means you get too much. And you look at it and say, where shall I give it to? And then I think you just, there's so much to be given. There are so many organizations, Christian organizations, particularly, let's say, in the field of culture, that are really needing money. So why don't you give it? You see? And I think that this whole question. So now in this framework, church buildings, I sometimes have inside of me a very radical answer to that. I don't think that we shouldn't have church buildings. You see, you can just hire, just like one of your churches, a YMCA building. That's good. Or maybe the hall of a church. That this is a perfect church. Why should you build a church 200 yards away from here? This is a church. And you just hire it for Sunday. And there's no need to build churches. But I would say, on the other hand, it's not sin to build a church. But how do you do it? And I think if you build a church, it should be good. It should be beautiful. That means done with good taste, but it should not be lavish. It should not be elaborate. If people show me, now that's the new church, it's a $10 structure, $10 million structure, then I feel something is wrong here. A church cannot build a $10 million structure. Something has gone out of focus. It's very difficult for you to understand. Of course, I'm coming from Holland. Now, Holland is the 10th most wealthy country in the world. So we're not, certainly not a third world proposition. You see. But I remember that a couple of years ago, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, I flew over with all my family to the west of Canada to give a course there. And I took my family with me for vacation. We landed in Vancouver. Somebody was there to pick us up. We drove with a car through Vancouver, and my children were angry. Simply angry. They said, this is impossible. These cars are too big. These houses are too big. It's too wealthy. It's an impossible world. If I hadn't stopped them, they had just gone back to the plane and flown back. Now, maybe if you come from India or Africa, if you land in Holland, you will say the same. That's quite possible. And I feel at a certain point we are too rich. I must say that I personally was very angry 15 years ago, when this happened. Let me give a little introduction. As a boy, we discussed everything. And I remember that as a boy, that's before the Second World War, we discussed television. And I still remember the group of boys that we did this with, that nobody doubted that television could be made. That was not a problem. But everybody agreed that this is something that will be so expensive that it would never become something general. Very soon after the war, you see television coming. Now, in 1960, about 1960, pick me on dates, but about 1960, Holland was in a very difficult economic position. Exactly at that moment, they introduced color television. And I found that sinful, a shame. Why do you build such very expensive stations in order to transmit, well, three times or four channels at the same time in order to have color television, which nobody needs? Why don't you use that money in a better way? And not only you got to build a station, but you got people got to buy new instruments. Why should people do this? Why do we have it? Just to have this color? Is that the value? Is it really weighing out? Are there not more important values than color television? In a way, every time I see color television, I have that feeling in my body. There's something too much here. Something that we spend too much on. And that's not the concert you're talking about with $10, but it is the whole way of doing in our country. Can we have a church building? The Lord never said that you couldn't have it. The Lord said that you should come together on a Sunday and have a congregation. It's very good if the congregation comes together in week time. So if you need a building for that, then the building, the function follows the form. I mean, the need for it creates the organization, and maybe you make a building. Now, we don't need to make a shed. We cannot just do as if we live in poverty while at home everything is in riches. Read Nehemiah, where it said, well, you have your beautiful homes rebuilt, and what about a temple? You see, there got to be a standard. If your house has a heating system, your church is going to have a heating system. It belongs together. You see, you're not going to have a church which is not built of stone when every house is built of stone. And so on. You can fill it in yourself. So there got to be a standard. And if you can avoid building a building just for making a building, which stands empty the whole week, well, that's maybe better not to have a church. But if you are going to build it, do it with good taste. Let it be an expression of the values you stand for. But that means also let it be not something that is lavish, using extraordinary marbles and things like that. Although it's nothing against marble. You see, it's again, you can never make these things in a legalistic way. But we've got to think about it. It's very important. So it is just a question of values. And of course, economics are just a weighing of values. And in America, I think many things have to be weighed in values. And I think that the Lord is always coming with his curse, his judgment on those things that people really, well, at the points of sin. And so if we read in the Bible that God is coming with his curses upon the nations that don't walk in his ways, it is no strange thing, it's not a miracle that exactly in our economics we, Europe as well as America, America as well as Europe, are really touched, because it's, the Lord says, I don't like you. I don't like the way you're handling this, and I'm going to take it out of your hands. And I think exactly that is the thing that we have to preach. That is our calling, to be evangelist in the biblical sense, that it means to talk like Jeremiah and Isaiah and say, turn back to the Lord. That means use your money in a better way. And if you read how the Bible says, I see too much poverty among you, I see how you mistreat poor people, how you don't care for it, well, then the Lord says, how have you been using the things I gave you? And I think that there is an unbalance of values in, let's say, our countries. Something to think about and something to act upon. But the answer is not be extremely poor. In fact, it has never worked. This answer has been given over and over again. Francis of Assisi, his father was extremely rich, and he saw the poverty of the world, and he said to his father, you can have it. He just undressed himself totally just to throw all the clothes to his father. He says, I don't want to have any of it. And that's the beginning of Francis of Assisi. He was violent and was strong, and maybe it was needed in those days. But nevertheless, less than one generation later in the Franciscan movement, you see that these things are completely gone. Some people try to live on these principles, but I think you can't live it because it was too extreme. We got to have a balance. And the balance is difficult, and we will make mistakes. Maybe in one day you go for $10 to a concert and said, why have you thrown away your $10? You shouldn't have done so. This was silly, foolish, sinful. And another time I would say, why didn't you go to that concert? Didn't you spend the $10? That was silly and sinful. You should have been there. And who is going to say whether I'm right or wrong? Yes. May I go into something which I have on my mind, which is, I think, important, and then I'm waiting for new questions, because I'm almost through. That's fantastic. Yes, there's quite a list, long list of it, but I think most basic questions have been answered. This is a kind of scheme that I've been developing in the last years. Oh, why should I take that book? I know it by heart. It is the 4 points. I'm thinking very much about where do we work as scholars. Where are our basic problems as scholars? So I'm just jumping out with the very practical little things that we're talking about. You see, $10 more or less, or $10 billion more or less. But now we're talking about sensible, very difficult things, scholarly problems. And I have 4 theses, and I just want you to think about them. They were implied in my very first lecture, and I want to make it explicit, and I just want you to think about it. I began to think about it maybe 20 years ago, and I'm feeling that I've come to the point that I can give them in 4 points, which is simplification, and that from now on I'm going to work, and I hope that many people will join me. What do we do if we think as scholars? Whether we're theologians or art historians makes no difference. Point one, nothing is certain. Nothing is certain. It's very foolish for man to think that in any way whatsoever he can ever make an assertion which is certain, that he can ever stand out and say, this is how it is, and stop. No scholarship will ever be final. No scholarship can say you, this is how it is. Scholarship is a human endeavor, is made by man, and therefore not only open to sin and everything that goes with it, but it is finite and open to mistakes. And basically, and this is very important, what we do in our work is discussion. We discuss. So somebody says, this is how it is. Tomorrow, one of your professors will read, will publish the final book on the interpretation of Matthew 12. The next day, somebody writes a criticism, says he hasn't understood anything about it, it's totally wrong, and there goes your final book, and we're in the midst of the discussion. Of course, he got an answer and some other answers, and 15 years later said, wasn't that an interesting discussion? And we have one little inch in the understanding about Matthew 12, and I'm not thinking about any particular problem, I'm just mentioning something. And then go on to the next. And so this is life. This is our work. But the starting point in this is that nothing is certain. Nothing is final. And we don't, it is just foolish to expect that we ever will get the final answers. And the worst place to look for is anything that is man-made. For instance, scholarship. Now, this statement is a rather simplified and maybe, I hope, a rather violent statement against all popular belief today. Because everybody looks at science to give the final answers. And the final answers today are, people expect to come from the scientist. Science and scholarship is the revelation that this world has and that it looks to. There we can know. You see, if somebody says, science has proved, everybody stops talking and says, yes, amen. No, they don't say amen, but the equivalent to that. You see? So we just accept it because it is science who has said it. Science has proved. Science has never proved anything. Science made an assertion, a tentative statement, which has to be proved to be true. And maybe it takes another 50 years that we found that it was completely wrong. I have found, maybe I said it before, but I'm re-saying it then, that the most dangerous statement is when people say, of course. Of course this is this like this. Well, if somebody says, of course, then be very, very critical. Because it means that most people agree. Well, if most people agree, it may be the superstition of our age. For instance, just to give you a nice little example, everybody today will say, of course, you have a subconscious. Well, I'm the only interesting guy in the company, says, I don't believe you have a subconscious. Where does it come from? It's a little invention of Mr. Freud. It's not even 100 years old. Well, there's a little prehistory in the Romantic era. I know there's a man about 50 years before Freud who began to talk about it. And as another good friend, a friend of mine, he's one of the other crazy guys, you know, this man said, they have invented the subconscious in order to fill up the hole that the absence of God created. So, well, this is something to think about. This is not a final answer, this is just the beginning of a question. The beginning of a question, but I think questions are the most important things. Questions are the real things we're talking about. And if we have a good question, only then we can expect to have a good answer, or at least the beginning of an answer. So I have a question. I say, I don't think that there is something like subconscious. So anybody who says, of course, then I would say, what are you talking about? Because these issues are very deep, but be very careful. Of course. I would say, of course, there is nothing like subconscious. And then other people begin to get nervous, and that's fine. Let's be nervous. So, nothing is certain. Never expect anything from human endeavor, because there's only one thing certain, and that is God. God is not the question mark, we are the question mark. God created, we are the creatures. Everything we do is relative. That means, has only meaning in relationship to God. And we can never get out of that relativeness. It's not relativism, because then I cut God out and then I'm just wandering around within and out an answer. No, but I'm relative in relationship to God. And nobody can get out of that because we're creatures. If you know something about Doiwit, that's what Doiwit means, meaning, when he says meaning. That is what Seefeld is talking about. But this is the relationship. So God is certain. Everything that we do is uncertain. This was Thesis 1. There are 4 theses totally, so we'll make it very soon. Not too difficult. Thesis 2. There are many, many, many things which are totally certain. I am very certain that I'm sitting at this moment on a table, speaking in a room, with a microphone before my head, to a bunch of Americans. And anybody would say that's a foolish statement, that's totally uncertain. I would say either you've got to go to the hospital or, well, there's something wrong. This is totally certain. There is no problem in my mind that at this moment we are in a suburb of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, United States, the Earth, this universe. Okay, that's the address. You see? There's no problem. We're quite certain about it. I'm very certain that the person who's sitting on the first line here is a woman. And I don't need to see her birth certificate to know so. And she doesn't need to prove it just by all the nudity we're talking about this morning. You see? Because she is a woman. And I would be very surprised if she wasn't, if she was a transvestite. That could happen, that kind of, but it's just a strangeness of transvestite that it is something strange because it falls out of, well, let's say, obvious experience. These chairs are blue. Don't say me that is a relativistic statement. They could be just as well red. Well, of course, they could be changed and you could repaint them, but they are blue. It's winter. It's still daytime. Well, I just can go on. I can go on for hours and hours. And if you drive through the landscape, it's foggy, some friend of yours is taking you to an unknown country, and you drive up the mountain, and then a friend says, now, wait a minute. At this point, it would be a lovely view. Of course, we don't see anything at this moment because it's all the fog. But if there was no fog, it was a lovely view. Most of us would not say, how do you know? Can you really prove this? I don't believe you before I've seen it. No, we will say, well, sorry, very sorry, they didn't show the lovely view that you talked about. Because we take things, well, certainties. Human, well, if he was a lunatic or if there was another situation, maybe I would say I doubt what you say. But usually we take these things for granted. And we cannot live without it. Life would be completely unbearable if we had not these certainties. The certainties that, well, just drive on a highway. 60 miles an hour. What you are really confident in that 200 yards away from you, the road is still there. You're not driving in a big hole. It may be that by an earthquake there is a big hole and you fall into it. Well, then we talk about the disasters in the paper next day. But you're not driving on that assumption because then you wouldn't be driving at all. You see, there may be things like this and maybe they warn you, be careful. There might be something like that happening. But certainly, we just live on certainties. I wouldn't dare to go to New York if I didn't know that New York existed, although I've never been there before. The plane is landing somewhere. But it's on the map. Well, the map refers to somebody's experiences, and we know where we can. We know even in real life, not in philosophical life, everything is a problem. That's point one. But in points two, many things are very certain. So we know, well, this is human experience. And we draw the line very finely between reality and fantasy. In the beginning of this book by Tolkien, there's a big map. It's a fantasy map. Well, the map that I get here at the gas station is a reality map. Both are maps. Nobody will confuse the two. And so there are many things are certain. This is very important because the certainty is exactly what we are to think about. Because it's a given. So I would say the most Christian thing in the world, and this is the basis of everything that we say, thank you, Lord, that you gave me this world, that you gave me my existence in the midst of this existence which we call creation. And this is the certainty that you made it. The end of this fantastic chapter in the Bible, Revelations 5, is the great song in the heavens of the heavens of the 24 elders that praise be unto the God who is the creator, and nothing is there but he willed it to be. And that's the basis of our acceptance and the certainty. It's based in which I ended with the first talk, our certainty is God who created. Well, that's the certainty that we talk about. Now, that certainty creates problems, this type of problems that we want to know, we want to investigate. We want to understand. And nobody will stop us because that's one of the things we are called to do. So God says, go ahead, investigate, try to find out, think about it. And so we go into it and we find out in the physics, macrophysics, microphysics, but also psychology, sociology, aesthetics, and so on and so on. And what we try to understand is exactly the given. That what is certain. I stand before the painting and I say, is that a beautiful painting? That's human certainty. Now the statistician comes and he says, why is it beautiful and what does it mean? And now we get into the uncertainties. Of course, everything I've been saying in this course is uncertainty, belongs to chapter one. But the paintings that I was projecting were slides after pictures. That was a certainty. And I couldn't make my lectures if I had not something to walk on and say, well, there is a Rubens. There is a Rubens and it depicts these men and women and these horses and so on. We discussed it the whole day yesterday. Well, we talk about something that's there. Now, what does it mean? How do we interpret it? What are the values? Well, many problems, questions, approaches, discussion. Well, that's fine. That's human. It's point two. And I think that's the most Christian point to begin with. It is, we don't start with thinking, but we start with accepting reality as something outside. And never follow those people who say, of course, these things are our thought forms. Of course, we make it. It comes of our brain. Evil things. Witchcraft. Conjuring things and so on. Yes, where are they? In our brains and imagination, I would say you have a great imagination, but it's outside. It's there to begin with. Be afraid of it. Kefa just had a very interesting story last night. He told me, I told another people too, that in Uganda there was a witch, and the witch called in the Christian, the pastor, and he said to the pastor, I want to be a Christian. And in order to be a Christian, I want to get rid of my witchcraft things. So they are buried in the back of the garden. And so the Christian pastor said, okay, I will ask some of my friends to come and dig it up. And two students, like you, came in order to dig up the things in the back of the garden. Within 2 hours, they couldn't dig anymore because their hands had got lame. They couldn't move anymore. Well, this was a great victory, of course, for the non-Christian powers in the country. Kefa's answer is, why were the hands lame? Because these kids didn't believe that there was real power there in the garden. They didn't pray before they go. They were not there as believers in the sense that the God is the God who is more powerful than the evil powers. No, they were just digging up some little stuff that some old, foolish, old-fashioned fantasy person like a witch doctor has buried there. And so we're just easily disposing of it. But God had to teach them, no, these things are real. And if you want to believe in me, you got to believe also in the realities of evil. You see, something like this. So it's out there. And I think that's very important. It's, of course, and this again goes against all the grains of current popular thinking. Everybody thinks different. And I think it's very important. Point three, all our experience is colored by our starting point. All our experience is colored by our starting point. If you are a Christian, look at the world with the Christian glasses. If you are a communist, you have red glasses. If you are a humanist, you have green glasses. If you are a Hindu, you have blue glasses, and so on and so on. I believe, but that's my belief, and of course my own glasses are applied. I believe that the Christian glasses are white, so that they don't disfigure reality. But that's my faith. Very hard to prove. So, what is the difference between my view and the view of Gombrich, who is a very fine humanist, and his friend Panofsky, and Antal, who is a Marxist, or Bexandl, who is another type of Marxist? What is our difference in our views? Or rather, how can we ever communicate? And I would say it's like this. Well, first, the difference. The difference is this, and this is a kind of metaphor that I've made for this. Just think about it a moment. I have in front of me tea, coffee, Coke, 7-Up, wine, sherry, think about something else. You can add to the line. what is the difference between all these things before me? Well, in fact, the difference is very little indeed. What's the difference between tea and coffee? It smells differently, it tastes differently, and it has a completely different meaning. You see, whether you offer somebody a glass of wine or a glass or a cup of coffee is a totally different gesture. Some may be right and some may be wrong at some moments. Some people you don't offer wine because they think they don't have the taste for it, and so on. You see, so you got to be careful. But these things have meaningfulnesses. But what do they differ? Well, interestingly, if you begin to think about it, they differ in 5%. Tea and coffee is both 95% water, and so is Coke, and so is most of the wine, etc., that we drink. It's mostly 95% water, but the 5% exactly counts. And so, to translate this metaphor back into the things we are thinking about, my experience and the experience of Mr. such-and-such the Marxist, and Mr. so-and-so the Maoist, and Mr. so-and-so the fundamentalist, and Mr. so-and-so the modern theologian, and Mr. so-and-so who is just simply a right-wing conservative without believing anything, well, all these people, they're all the same, and so far they're all human, and for 95% they all have the same experience. And the coloring or disfiguring, whatever it is only 5%. That means, and that's the basis of the last point, that there can be communication. Because we have so much in common. We are not just differently, we're not just glasses, to use the other metaphor, colored glasses, but we have eyes and we see, and there's an outside world that we look at. So there is a very direct relationship. And there is something that we go by. So, there is all our experience is colored by our starting point. That means, at the same time, that goes against the grain of all modern scholarly superstition that you can ever get at objective results. People ask me, my students ask me, we want to have objective truth. And I answer them, you're a fool, because that would be unhuman. What you can get from me is personal knowledge. And I'm quoting the title of that very important book of Polanyi that I think should be on the proscribed reading of every theologian, including the people here, of course. So I think you've got to read that book, personal knowledge. We can never go beyond personal knowledge, and we should never try to do that, because as soon as we go beyond that, we don't know anything anymore, because it becomes totally unnecessary, becomes totally inhuman knowledge. What the computer knows is usually completely superfluous knowledge. We see it today that under the aegis of this, every more and more historians begin to republish old things. So in the end, you have a complete library of republications of old things. But nobody ever reads them and tries to assess what they mean, because then it becomes personal and subjective. And of course, they become personal and subjective, but that's exactly what's worthwhile talking about. You see, and just the republication in the end becomes an escape. And that's what we call scholarly. And I think the scholarly thing is just a real phony thing. That's just a superstition of our age. As a Christian, I say no to that. I don't want to fall in that. And I teach my students, you're fools. You're asking for something which is strange and which is nonsensical. You want to be human, and you cannot escape being human. Why should you try to escape to be human? And of course, it's so fascinating that we as human can say things which are real. And we start from such a strong reality, and that we are completely certain about. That beautiful painting by Rubens. And now we go into interpretations. Of course, all my interpretation is my personal knowledge. And nobody can do it in this way. Nobody has ever talked about that Rubens in my way. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to say, look how great I am. I'm only saying that that's what I cannot avoid being. That is me. And of course, everybody else who would talk about it would just as well talk in a personal way about it. Well, let's what we say personally be of good standards. That's another thing. Let's try to talk sense. Try to get deep into things, of course. There are standards of knowledge. But I'm not talking about the standards, I'm talking about the quality of it, the personality of it. And it's colored. So no experience is without coloring, which is a qualification of what I said in the second statement. I said everything, there are many things that are certain. In the third thing I say, everything that we talk about and saying it's certain is colored by our understanding. Of course it is. Now point four, and this is, I think, the real mystery. It's a real mysterious point. I must say that I don't understand. I wished I could explain. If I could explain, I was the greatest philosopher of all ages. Of course, there has been much thought on this point. Of course, I don't think there has been enough thought on this point. The point is the point of communication. Although we do communicate out of our experience, and we can only see the world through our colored glasses, nevertheless we can communicate. One of the reasons that we are creatures in creation, so that we're 95% water in my equation, in my metaphor. You see, so we can talk. We can talk. But the wonder of it is the real miracle, the real mystery also, because I can't explain it. And it's less like this. Mr. A writes a play. And the play is played in the theater. Mr. A was an existentialist. Mr. B is a humanist. Mr. B looks at it and he writes a criticism. Of course, looking with his eyes at that play and interpreting it in his way. And there's a clash of opinion there. Then Mr. C reads the criticism of Mr. B. He is one of your nice little Christian friends. Now, this Mr. C talks to you, your D. The interesting thing is that in listening to them, it's not very difficult to reconstruct the play A to know what it was about, because you understand that your Christian friend misunderstood, of course, completely what Mr. B meant when he said this and this and this in talking about A. And you understand that B was a man of that and that color, and that's why he said it that way. So it's not difficult to reconstruct in your mind what A was about. But not only that A was, of course, a specific vision on reality, but you can even find out what the reality is talking about. And I think that's a real mystery, how you can explain these things, these very complex communications. I just give you a very simple example. But that's the way that we read books. In a book, you have a quote, and the quote talks about another man, and that man talks about another man again. And that talks about reality, and you say, and you can compare. He said that all the hills are green. Are hills green? Yes. So at least as far as he's talking about the fact that hills are green, he is not completely foolish. He is right to a certain extent, but he also says this, and there he misses the point. So you can't compare him to reality because you know about the reality that he's talking about. All the you have your glasses on, and they all have their glasses on. And they differ as much as tea and coffee and coke and wine. That's a real mystery. And I think that's the basis of all our work. Of course, it's a difficulty. It's complex. And it's a basis, of course, also of hermeneutics. If you read the Bible, people are talking, they are giving sermons. The Bible is one big sermon about the God who created this world and the greatness of this world, etc., etc. But you can read it and understand it. And you know, oh yes, everybody understands, because the colored glasses can be deep, deep problems. Problems about, the basic points in the existence and so on and so on, basic questions of epistemology. But it can be as very superficial as just the social environment. Not superficial in the sense of not important, but not very deep in the spiritual sense. So, for instance, in my church, and every Sunday they read the law. And so every Sunday people listen to a very important statement that they should not covered the ass of their neighbor. Now, of course, nobody in my community living in the city of Amsterdam would ever love to have an ass. That was the greatest burden in the world. It was just the most thing everybody dreams about of never having. And the neighbors don't have it. So it's a silly statement. Don't cover the ass of your neighbor. No, but because everybody understands that's not what he's talking about. Everybody understands what he does talk about. And that's why we can have this communication. It's not foolish to say so. And we immediately, everybody, not only the learned and the wise, but even the foolish, the children, immediately take away, they put on their glass and take away the other glass and look at the reality of the big things that other people have, our own sinfulness, because we want to have it too, our pride, our greed, and all these things. And we know the Lord says, be careful, don't touch. Very simple. No, very simple, very complex as communication. If I begin to think about it, now all the theories I may build on it fall under statement one. They're all uncertain, they all fall below the line of interpretation. But we first got to accept, and I think it belongs to the certainties of B, that the things are like this. Where is the Bible in my story? I think it belongs to B, the certainties that we cannot discuss. The coveting of the S of our neighbor. The things the Bible talks about, God created the world, they don't belong to human uncertainties. That's where the modern theologians place them, because they think that they're man-made statements. But I say, although man was implied, although it's personal knowledge, and therefore important knowledge, the knowledge of Moses and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Paul, it's exactly the great miracle again that it's so personal, but nevertheless states universal, and that universal is in the realm of the same kind of realm when I say it's raining outside, the sun is shining, we are sitting in a room, some of you are men, some of you are women, we have light turned on, I hear the heating system, rather annoying. Why don't you Americans invent a better heating system that doesn't make noise? These things, very certain. You see, these are the points that I wanted to point out and I want to bring to you. I think that they are very important. If we have time, maybe tomorrow I can go into art history as a discipline and what it means. I even have a lecture on certainty in science, scholarship, art history. But it would be interesting to discuss that, because you look at a different angle, and so you maybe the confrontation of people from different disciplines is helpful. I don't know how far we get, but first we're going to now have a little intermission. I hope to get many more questions so we can do something this afternoon. I won't make it too late because I got to hop over to the other place. One of my difficulties is a very great difficulty, and that is creating very often uncertainties and difficulties where there was no necessary to be so. And let me explain. If somebody asks a question, the question usually comes out of a framework, the framework in which that person is thinking and working. Now, if I answer the question straightforward, like, how late is it? It's that late. That's a straightforward answer. Then, of course, not in this particular example, but if it's a bit more complex, then I probably missed the point. So, as an example, in La Brie, very often people have been asking this question, how do you know that God exists? And I know that for years I've been answering that question. And I know the answers. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a Christian. But at some moment, I completely stopped answering that question because my answer was not the answer. Because the questions always come out of a Cartesian framework of thought. Now, within a Cartesian framework of thought, I cannot answer that question because the Cartesian framework of thought is made to get God out of the picture. So it's a useless answer. So since that time, I always have been answering in this way, saying, now listen, your question is a good question, but your framework is a wrong framework. And I try to analyze the framework and show what is a better framework, and then within that framework I can answer your question. That is a very difficult complication of communication. And we got to be very careful of it. I must say that I feel a little bit uncertain here, because I know roughly who you are, Christian, American, but that's in a way too vague. Sometimes I don't know the framework in which you are thinking, and so maybe sometimes I will miss the point because I'm answering in a different framework than you think that the answer is given in. And that is a difficulty, and we got to think about that, and that's a complication that comes in the let's say, the combination of one and three, the uncertainties of human talk and the fact that we look through a certain colored glasses. And the coloring is not just Christianity and humanism. The coloring is American 1975 Christian from this denomination out of that and that school. You see, it is very precise.